sahana bhavatu, sahanao bhunaktu, sahaviryam karavavahai, tejasvinavatitamastu madhidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shanti. You have one, Gary? Do you have a seduction? Give it to Anne. Yeah. If you come in regularly, then you come in. If you just forgot yours, then use it as a library book. Ready? Johnny, you can share with page 28. And I mean verse 28.
Verse 28.
You find it? What page is it on?
66.
Okay. Oh, yeah. 83. Okay. Is it ready? Bhave hamasarvamidam vipati. Tasmadaham rupamidam samastam. Tasmadaham rupamidam samastam. Tan marganam sarvajayaya margaha. Bhave ahamaha sarvam idam vibhati. Laye ahamaha na eva vibhati kinchit. Tasmat aham rupam idam samastam tat marganam. Ten is a Sunday. Ten marganam sarva jayaya margaha. Okay. Says, Bhave Ahamaha. When the aham is there, means the ahankara. Well, I'll get into that in the middle. Literally, aham means I. Ahamaha is putting the word I, aham, in the genitive set case. So in that locative, Bhave means when there is being, when the aham is existing, when there is being for the aham, means when the ahankara is up, okay? When the I is up. Sarvam idam, all of this means this whole world of experience, vibhati, shines. So when the aham is up, when the ahankara is up, sarvam idam vibhati, all of this shines. Laye ahamaha, when the ahankara or when the I is resolved, laye means when resolved, when the I is resolved, then na eva kinchit, nothing at all, vibhati, shines. So, when the I is up, like the I am, I see, I know. When the I is up, then all of this shines. When it is, like in deep sleep, for instance, when it is laya. Laya means in a resolved or dissolved condition. When we talk just these words, laya, when we talk about the creation itself as something which manifests, is sustained, and resolves, we say stiti, Shrishti, the creation that comes into being. Stiti, it's remains, and laya, it goes into resolution. The same for the jiva, when the mind is awake, comes into being, right? It becomes manifest, like from deep sleep, and then it's awake, and then it goes into unmanifest condition, that's the laya. And so when the mind wakes up, the aham is there, and when the aham is there, all of this shines. When the mind goes into unmanifest condition, none of this shines, none of this is known. Okay? So then he says, tasmat. This word tasmat, Swamiji is always joking with this word. Tasmat means therefore. Okay? So now we've just given two lines of logic that are going to resolve in a therefore. So this is the logic. When the eye is up, right? So when the mind is awake, I'll unfold this more in a minute, but when the mind is awake, this everything that you're perceiving, all of this, so sarvam idam, idam means what is near to you. So all of this, which comes into my, it comes into being, right, for me. When the mind resolves, or when the ahankara, the eye, is in laya, then none of this shines. Okay? Tasmat, therefore, aham rupam idam samastam. All of this, idam means this, samastam means all, like sarvam idam, samastam idam. All of this is aham rupam. It has for its nature the I. You could even say it's a form of the I. Okay? Aham rupam. Then he says, tanmarganam, inquiring into that, aham, inquiring into that, sarvajayaya margaha, is the marga, is the path for victory over everything. Jaya means victory, for victory over everything, sarvajaya. Okay, so I'll tell you how the Bhasha deals with that. So let's look at this. There's a couple of verses here. There's a set, so we're going to do at least one more verse to make this work. Ramana is teaching his verses, he's almost always going from just the standpoint of the jiva and not taking Ishvara into account in certain ways. And so sometimes it's hard for me to teach it because I always want to go from, not that you don't have to do this, but I'm just kind of trained to go from, once I resolve the jiva, then I have to go out and resolve the Ishvara, right? But what Ramana does is just trying to make you understand something from the standpoint of your own experience, the experience of you as a being here. Not that he doesn't account for Ishvara, but a lot of the unfoldment is just from the perspective of you as a jiva. And so this is what he's saying here. Let me remind you of this one little piece of logic before we go on. There's a logic called anvaya vyatireka. The anvaya vyatireka goes like this, and this is a logic that we use a lot. Okay, the logic goes like this. The anvaya is showing the relationship, the positive relationship between two things, and it goes like this. When this is, that is. If this is there, that is there. When this is, that is. That's the envy. That's the positive. The vyatireka is the negative. When this is not, that is not. That is an unbhaya vyatireka showing the dependence of two things, one upon the other. And so, if this can only be there when that is, right? And both ways, this is there when that is there, and when that is not there, this is not there. So that means there's a definite dependency upon the two. They're very related to each other. If, on the other hand, the anvaya is there, but not the vyatireka, then there's no relationship. Like if I were to say, when this is, that is, but when this is gone, that still is. Right? When this is, that is, so that's the anvaya, but the vyatireka doesn't work. When this is gone, that still is. When that's the case, you may have thought there's a relationship, right? But you find out upon inquiry that there's no relationship. So now, normally, when we use this unbhaya vyatireka, we show its failure. We're showing the failure. For instance, we'll use unbhaya vyatireka to say, when the waking state is, I am. And the vyatireka would be, and when the waking state is not, I'm not. But that isn't true. So that means that we're going to say like this. When the waking state is, I am. When the waking state is replaced by the dream state, right, I still am. If I say like that, which is how we commonly use anvaya vyatireka, what I'm showing is that there's a what we call an anuvritti. There's a continuation of my own presence, which is not dependent on any sort of experience. I don't require, my being doesn't require the waking state in order to be, because I can be with a dream state. I can be with a deep sleep state. I can be devoid of any type of knowership or any type of enjoyership, because the waking state is negated by the dream state, and both of those states are negated by the deep sleep state. And so I still am, and I am without any one of those three experiences, each one negating the other. And so that means in my own experience, my being is free from the totality of each one of those experiences. And so, for instance, in the waking state, there's the body, mind, sense organs, that is aware of this world. That's totally negated by the dream state, where there's another subtle world and a subtle body. It could be a different body and a whole different set of experiences. That's totally negates the waking state, and vice versa. And in the deep sleep state, what is negated is all duality, really, and even the subject-object-knower-known relationship. And what's important about that is in that deep sleep state, I am without knowership, without subject-object relationship, you know. If I can be without that, I can't be that. See, if I am intrinsically any one of those things, I can't be without it. Because if the instant I'm without it, I'm here and that's gone. And so there's not an intrinsic relationship there. So this anvaya vyatireka is very, very important. And this is how it's normally used. We even use it in the waking state to help you differentiate your being, the satchit, your very being, from your thoughts and your emotions and your perceptions. All of the experiences you have as a living being, you know, your sensory perception and all the different states of mind that you have, from the buddhi to the citta to the memory to the emotions, all of these things are subject to anvaya vyatireka. Because you would always say like this: when this thought is, I am. When this thought goes, I still am. When this emotion is, I am. When this emotion is gone, I am. So you can say that just intellectually, and it works logically, that's wonderful. But these words, this anvaya vyatireka logic, is pointing to the reality of your experience. And so you have to be able to use it like this. When this thought, and of course one thought replaces another. Sometimes, in fact, Swamiji will do a guided meditation where he'll say things like chair, plant, table, Son. Just one word after another word after another word after another word. Just so that you can watch the flow of vrittis, of thoughts, or just provide a flow for you. So that you can recognize as the vrittis are coming and going, you're remaining as the constant. If you're remaining as the constant, then you can't be. You have to be able to discriminate in your own subjective experience what is staying and what is going. And that's the logic that Anvayavyatireka. When this is, I am. When this is not, I still am. When this mood is, I am. When this mood is gone, I still am. Who still is? So if you discern your experience and watch the changes and at the same time recognize your own being, then you can do this viveka. Viveka means discrimination. You do this, you make this discrimination of your inner experience. Your inner experience, why I'm saying inner experience is this. Through my sense organs, right, I'm having perceptions of this room, for instance, which are forming a thought modification in my mind. Right? If I use my eyes to form a thought modification in my mind. So now when I say my inner experience, what I'm talking about is me, the conscious being that I am, plus this thought modification. You know? It can also, the thought modification can be a memory. So it's a mental state, what we call an antikarana vritti. Antikarana means your mind. Vritti means actually an activity of your mind. We translate, though, this antikarana vritti as a thought modification. So through my sense organs, I'm taking in perceptions of the room, which are all thought modifications. But if I look here, I have a thought modification. If I look here, I have a thought modification. If I have a memory, I have a thought modification. If I have imagination, thought modification. Antikarana vritti. So for short, we just say vritti. So vritti means a thought modification. So all of these vrittis, they can be perceptions, they can be memories, they can be the ahankara, they can be daydreaming, imagination, emotions, right? All the complex states of mind that we have, each one is a vritti. Okay, so that's, in a sense, half of my internal experience. The other half, we want to say half just for fun, it's not really like that, but anyway, is my presence, me, the one for whom all of these vrittis are, right? The one thing that all of these vrittis have in common, no matter what it is, whether it be an emotion or a memory or a perception or an intellection or an imagination, it doesn't make any difference. Whatever, the one thing that is always present is me, the conscious being that is present and because of whom this vritti is known, right? And so what I can do, a viveka, a discrimination, internal discrimination of my inner experience to recognize me and everything else. I am, and then every vritti, everything else is just a vritti. Right? Because that's my inner world, is myself and these vrittis. And I can differentiate my being, the constant, from every type of vritti, whether it be an emotion or a perception, etc. And how do I recognize it? Well, especially, you know, if you slow everything down and just sit in meditation just to be a little bit quiet and be able to just be with your inner experience, you can discern your own presence from that which is changing. It's very simple. Just discern your own presence from that which is changing. Okay? And so, and your presence is something which is constant because it is conscious being itself. It never dims. It never comes and goes. It's the self-evident, the self-evident me. Now, when we say self-evident, what we mean by that is that yourself doesn't need another luminary to come and light it up. It's self-evident because existence or being itself, the me itself, is consciousness. So if you are your own light, you know, you don't, you know, like if we use the example, the sun, doesn't, we'll say the sun, which illumines everything, doesn't need a sun behind it illumining it, right? Nor does it need anything that's being illumined to shine back at it so that it can know itself. It is its own self-luminous nature. So we say the sun is self-luminous. So we'll use that word self-luminous to highlight the conscious being of myself. We can also say self-luminous swaprakasha is the word swaprakasha, self-luminous, or self-evident swetasiddha, self-evident. It all means that I don't need my mind to make me known. It's because of the self-evident me, the conscious being that I am, that the mind is known. And so if you discern, if you look at your experience, then what you'll see is that the knownness, the conscious being, is the constant, and the vrittis, one after another, rise into knownness or rise into consciousness, rise and set, or I think of vrittis more as kind of a stream. One thought begets the next thought, begets because of association, begets the next, begets the next, begets the next. But the stuff of them, the being, the existence, the self-evident existence, the self, which is your own me experience, when you say me or I am without the words, those words pointing to it, that remains the same. So this anvaya vyatirika is, this is the normal way that we use it all of the time to help us make this viveka, make this discernment, okay? Now, Ramana is using it in a different way. What he's saying is this, and this is also true. Now what he's saying is that when the I is, and now what he means is this, the I is the aham, means the ahankara. So now I have to explain this, ahankara. Without the mind, there's no ahankara. Ahankara means the I notion. But when the mind is up, right, the ahankara, because when the mind by its nature, okay, let me go into this just a little bit. I have to use some other words. When we talk about Maya, we say Maya is responsible for the manifestation of the whole creation. Everything. From perception, from knowership, from enjoyership, to all the objects in the creation, all the movement of the creation, everything that is manifest in the creation, including the knower-known relationship, exists because of Maya. So you can think of it, if you think of the dream, for instance, as Maya. And Maya means that which totally depends upon something else for its being is Maya. It has no being of its own. Don't worry about that right now. Just think about what happens when Maya projects. You as an individual, you have your little bit of Maya when you have a dream or when you have an imagination or when you project a snake on a rope. You have this creative capacity. But now look at what is involved in this creative capacity called Maya. If you can imagine a world, you do it all of the time in dream. You imagine a world, right? But when you imagine that world, there's things happening in it. There are names and forms that are pervasive. There's the five elements, space, air, fire, water, earth. And all of the elementals, all of these elements moving together to form different namarupas, names and forms, names and forms, names and forms. So there's a vast projection of names and forms. That vast projection of names and forms, they say, that is tamas. They break Maya into sattva, rajas, and tamas because they want to account for everything in this creation. So if you just look at now, if you look at this room, okay, there's a vast display of names and forms. That's because of the tamas quality that allows for inertness in a sense, for nama-rupa, for name and form. But then there's something else you notice. All of these names and forms are moving. There's constant motion. That's the rajas quality, what is responsible for the movement that pervades the entire creation of duality. So you have nama-rupa, names and forms, and you have movement. Now there's something else. Inert, names and forms, lots of motion, every pervasive to the whole creation, but there is also knowership. The knowership, the ability for there to be knowership or enjoyership, is because of what they say, sattva. Sattva is that which reflects consciousness. As opposed, like this lamp, from its own standpoint, doesn't reflect consciousness. Whereas a human being has a mind and sense organs. And as long as the mind and sense organs are functioning, and they'll say that it as though is a chitta-bhasa, it as though reflects consciousness, allows consciousness to manifest in it, as opposed to something like a lamp or this chair. It doesn't, from its own standpoint, have a sense of being conscious. Right? It can be known, but this chair doesn't have a sense of being conscious, nor does this, nor does this, nor does this cup. Yeah. But living beings have a sense of being conscious. Plants have a sense of being conscious. Human beings, animals, insects, all living creatures have a sense of being conscious. What allows for that sense of being conscious is what they call sattva. It allows for the consciousness to be manifest in it, allows for therefore to be knowership and enjoyership. That's all because of sattva. So I'll say that maya is made of this sattva, rajas, and tamas. Okay? Now, sometimes I use the example, the shastra uses the example just to kind of make this understood. Say if you have a rock and a mirror, two inert materials that I hold up to the sun. Right? They're both inert. The mirror isn't conscious, right? It's a mirror, right? It's made of physical material. And so is the rock. They're both not the sun. Let's put it that way. They're both not the sun. But the sun, as though, abides in and reflects in the mirror. Right? It doesn't in the rock. So that mirror, that mirrorness, right, is what we call sattva. And the rock doesn't have that sattva. So we'd say the sattva is what is called the sukshma sharira, the subtle body, the mind, the antakarana, and the sense organs are sattva. Because your sense organs are able to know, that with blessed by the mind, you gain knowership through your five sense organs, and the mind also, being sattva, reflects all of experience. So the mind, which allows for like the manifestation or reflection of consciousness, also takes on vritti after vritti, or thought modification after thought modification after thought modification. And at the same time, enjoys awareness. It is illumined. Okay? And has a sense of being known. Everybody with me on this? Okay, so now, when the mind is up, so you're awake, right? That mind, because it is sattva, is never without a sense of I. Just like if it's day out and a mirror is focused on the sun, for instance, it will never feel, right, that it's not the sun. Because it's illumining, it's being illumined by the sun, and the sun seems to abide, the reflection of the sun seems to abide in it. Okay? That's not the best analogy. It has some weak spots in it. But anyway, let's play with it for a while. So because now, you can't stick with an analogy, they're all imperfect, but they kind of point in the direction that I want you to go. So let's look at it like this. When your mind is up, when your mind is awake, what happens is But the mind awake will be having its experiences. Either it's daydreaming, or it's perceiving, you know, or it's thinking about this or that, all the while having a sense of I. Right? It has a sense of I am. Right? Now the thing is, the sense of I, that me-ness, is actually Brahman. That is actually the self. But the mind, the sattva, right, which is made of sattva, it is never without the enjoyment of that self, as long as it's awake, right? And so what it will say now is, I am. It doesn't even have to say it. You know, that is its understanding. It doesn't have to walk around saying, I am, I am, I am. It just, that is the understanding. And so when the mind is up, so what he's saying is, it's like when the eye is up, right? Because of this mind. So when the mind is awake, the eye is up, and the eye being up because of the sattva, it's not up by itself. It's never up by itself. It's up, when it is up, the perception is also up. So all of this, whatever is being experienced, comes with this I am. The mind is awake, so I am. And then all of this is there. See what I mean? Because without the mind being up, awake, this isn't there. And so, but when the mind is awake, I am. From the standpoint of the mind. But when it says I am, all of this also is. But when the mind goes to sleep, there's no one there saying I am. There's no, that the I am-ness goes into unmanifest condition. And so does all of this. See this? Are you with me? So all of this goes into unmanifest condition. So now, that being the case, anvayavyatireka. When I am, means as this knower is present, all of this is. When I am not, means this knower, the sattva, is not present, none of this is. So what does that mean? The ahankara, which he refers to the ahankara, the chitabhasa, this reflection of consciousness, which is the ahankara. Now I have to explain that a little bit. Well, I'm explaining this in Ramana's way, and it's actually really beautiful, but I want to make sure that it's understood. So when the mind is up, right, and that's the same thing as saying when the ahankara is up, because the ahankara is not just the I statement, it's the fact of it. It's that ajnanam, when the I is up, means when the mind is up, that mind is the I from its own standpoint because of ajnanam. So when this I is up, all of this is. Right? So all of this experience is dependent on that I being up, that mind being up. When the mind goes into unmanifest condition, all of this is gone. The I is gone and all of this is gone. And so therefore, doing that anvayavyatireka, when this is there, that is there. When this is gone, that is also gone. Right? And so that's what he says. So he says, when the I is up, all of this shines. When there's a laye ahamaha, when the I goes into a manifest condition, nothing at all shines, nothing at all appears. Tasmat, therefore, all of this is nothing but the I. It says, he says, aham rupam. It is just, all of this is just a form of that ahankara. It's never separate from it. So when you think of it, you don't have an awake mind, right? Without that I, but that awake mind includes all of this, all of these experiences. And so he's saying, therefore, you know, this all comes together. So then he says, so that being the case, tan marganam, when you start to inquire into that I, into the source of that I, you start inquiring into what is actually there. Then he said, he says, that leads to, that becomes the path toward, he says, Sarvajaya. Sarvajaya means conquering everything. How he says that in the Bhasha, he says, Sarvesham Sanganam Jayaya means Jayaya, means one renounces all attachment. One that is the path for giving up all attachment, because none of this has, what, from Ramana's standpoint, as you'll see in the next verse, none of this has any reality at all. It has no reality because the whole thing comes and the whole thing goes. And when you start analyzing that, the source of it, what's underneath it, as you'll see in the next verse, there's one thing that's not coming and going. Everything else is just simply nitya. Nitya means it has no, it neither does the ahankara nor the objects of enjoyment have any reality at all, because they all come into manifestation and they all go out of manifestation. So they have no being at all. There's nothing there to be attached to. Who is the real person in all of this? The real person, is it going to be something that goes into unmanifest condition? And this, all of this that's manifest, including the ahankara, right? It's there when it's manifest, but the ahankara and all of this goes into unmanifest condition. And you are the ones, we'll see in the next verse, that's remaining. So when that is understood, you're saying, where is there anything to be attached to? Because there's nothing that has any substance or reality. That's how he's viewing it. Remember that Ramana is always, it's always the who am I question. What he wants for his students to always actually, as we'll see, two verses from now, we'll get to it today, but is to actually meditate, you know, to just bring your mind into a meditative state. And let this word I come up, the I am. Just let yourself even say I am. And follow it back to what is its source, you know? Instead of the I that comes with the mind and resolves into the mind, can resolve when the mind goes into laya, into unmanifest condition, who is the one that is there, not coming and going, right? The thing that anvayavyatireka is, there's two levels of anvayavyatireka. When the mind is up, all of this is. When the mind is in unmanifest condition, all of this is gone. So then who are you? Okay. All of your experience that you have within duality is mithya. It's not real because you can be without it. So what is there to be attached to? Who is the one that is really here? So there's two levels of anvayavyatireka. One of them is positive. When the mind is up, this is. When the mind is resolved, this is not there. The other anvayavyatireka is, when this state is, I am. When this state is not, I still am. When this state is, I am. When this state is not, I still am. That's the failed anvayavyatireka, right? And so you have to be able to use both. He's using this in a very interesting way, showing the mityatva of the knower-known relationship. You know what mitya means? Mitya, let me just explain that for some of you who might not remember this relationship. The whole Vedanta actually depends on this understanding. It's actually a prakriya. It's called satyam mitya. Satyam is always the, satyam means the truth. The truth means that which is actually here. Mitya means that which has no being of its own, but depends solely on the truth of what is actually here. it has no independent reality. And so the example we use for satyamitya, two examples, basic examples. We use the clay pot. Like the pot depends on the clay totally. And in fact, there's nothing but clay. The satyam is the clay. That is what is actually there. The pot has no independent being, but we have to account for it because it's there. But it has no independent reality at all. Zero. The only thing that is there is clay. So what is satyam. What is dependent on satyam is mithya. But the dependence on it means is total. Means there is nothing there. Mithya, there's nothing there, but there it is. Right? Because we can say that about the relationship between the clay pot. There's nothing there but clay, but there's the pot. Right? But I can't take the pot off over here and the clay here. I can't divide them. Because if I try to remove the, if I remove the clay, there's nothing. Right? So here, what we're searching for in this anvayavyatireka is what is satyam and what is mithya. Okay. So now, if we're looking for, in my experience, what is satyam, and first of all, we have to understand what a definition of satyam must be. It is the way the Sanskrit translation of it is that which cannot be negated in past, present, or future. Means it is. There's no negation. It can't come into being and it can't go out of being at all. That means that it is an infinite presence without free of time. That's what that means. And the reason for that is if something were to come into being and go out of being, if that were to happen, then that has to be mithya, right? Because the logic is this. If something actually comes into being, then what is its prior condition? If it comes into being, then its prior condition is non-being, non-existence. And if it goes out of being, its posterior condition is non-existence. And nothing can actually come from non-existence because it's not there. Right? And so, if it is there, we say it must be mithya. It has to be dependent on something else, right, for it to be. Because non-existent, if you take the word seriously, we're not talking about shunya, emptiness. That's different. Emptiness we can use for awareness itself, for being pure being itself. But when we use the word, what we're using, not shunya, we're using the word non-existence, and you have to take the word seriously. If something is not there, zero, nothing, nothing can come of that because there's nothing there for it to come from, right? And so if you say that something which is bordered by non-existence, then that thing which you're experiencing as isness has to be dependent upon something else because nothing can come from non-existence. So we say the definition of reality or something that is actually there, is actually real, can't come into being or go out of being. It has to be timeless, free from time. Everything else that is subject to change must depend upon that in the end. Right? Because otherwise, you can say that this thing that comes into being and goes out of being depends on this thing that is moving slower in terms of coming into being and going out of being, which depends upon these things that are moving slower. But there's an infinite regress. In the end, something has to be there. And that something that has to be there has to be free of name and form, because name and form exist within duality, and that which exists in duality is bound by change. If it's bound by change, it's mithya. It has bordered by non-existence. So on and on and on and on it goes. So in the end, there has to be something which actually is, and that something which is cannot have name and form. If it has name and form, then it's bound by duality and bound by change. And so, if there is such a thing, which there has to be, because otherwise there is nothing. See what I mean? That's the problem. It has to be, because otherwise there's nothing and there's no conversation. Because here we are having a conversation. Here I am and you are. And this amness, if we go into our own experience, in fact, the amness, taking away the words, you know, is the constant that I can never escape. It is the constant of every experience that I have. But every single experience that I have, other than my self-evident amness, is coming and going. And so, like that, with the ahankara, which has knowership, endurership, enjoyership, because of the mind, you know, when that is up, the world is up. When that is down, there is no world. That means that the knower known all come together as a package. The mind comes up, the world is up. The mind goes down, the world is down. Right? It's a package. It's interdependent. Right? And so this interdependent package, right, has nothing to do with me other than I am its changeless self. I am its satyam. I am the satyam. I am the being which all of this depends upon. So, our task, I mean, this is a lot of philosophy, but it's not philosophy. It's philosophical, you know, and there's a lot of logic involved. There's a lot of understanding involved. But all of these, this understanding is actually pointing to your experience. In the end, this understanding and all these words have to resolve into your recognition of the changelessness of your nature and differentiating that from everything that you experience in terms of a satyam-mitya relationship. The satyam-mitya relationship means this, that all of this experience that comes and goes is, in fact, has no being whatsoever other than me. Because anything that's bordered by non-existence, that means anything that changes, has no being. It has no being because it has no being except for that which has been. That is, its, what has been is its being. Like for the clay pot, and it is as radical as the clay pot. The pot is not anything. The only thing that is there is clay. And like that, all of this is not anything. It's only me. It's only being, and I am that being. Everything that can come and go and is bound by change has to have being as its support. It's a radical support, like clay pot support. And so, if that's understood, then you can understand the experience, like the dream, is such an Achilles heel, you know, to the reality of duality. It's just, think about your experience. There's this experience, what do you call it, like a liminal experience. The moment that you wake up from a dream, that moment, that critical moment when the dream disappears, right? You wake up and the dream disappears and absolutely nothing has happened. That is an incredible experience, that such a universe, which is so real for all of those who are within it, you know, experience from within, like us in this room right now. It's so real, you know. The duality is so real. But when it goes away, absolutely nothing happens, because nothing happens to what is. And you are. You are what is. And there's not even a quiver. Now that's satyam-mitya. And for what is, there can be no quiver. A quiver is a change, right? A change is mitya, because it's bordered by non-existence. So now what you have to do is just walk around. So you walk around in this world and recognize that all of this activity is going on. You are walking, your hands are moving, your eyes are seeing, your voice is talking, all of this stuff is going on, and nothing is going on. At this very same time, that you are absolutely free. Your being, there is no change whatsoever, and it is you. Now, that's the other thing. These words are philosophical, and so it's hard for these philosophical words to land on simple me. Just me. My own simple presence, the very me that I take to be me, but have assumed that this simple me that makes me me is really because of this body. And so all of these words miss me because I am so convinced, because of lifetimes, beginningless ignorance, that the me that I really am is this body, and Vedanta is talking about something else. Some more bigger me or something. A me to be discovered. It's not at all talking about a me to be discovered. It's talking about the very me that you take yourself to be right now, and you have to notice that it is this me that is Satyam. This very simple me. And once you notice, you just gotta have to notice this me, and once you get it, then you say, oh my God, they're really talking about me. And that's when I had that, you know, experience of walking down the pathway in the ashram many years ago. They're talking about me, and then I couldn't believe it. That's when I started turning like this and walking and, you know, seeing if I could get rid of it. And I couldn't. And then that's when this kind of highfalutin idea of the self was reduced to just this very personal me that makes that you think of yourself right now. You just try to get rid of it. Just notice who do you take to be this body? This me that is this body. And then you do all kinds of meditations and all try to do all, have all kinds of experiences to try to budget. And you'll find this, there's not, absolutely nothing you can do, and that is the only thing that you can't get rid of. Like you can have imaginations about a spiritual self that you're going to discover, or a spiritual experience of a blissful self that you can experience when you make your mind quiet. That, if that experience can go away, it's not you. What we're talking about is something much more basic and much more real and much more of a relief. We don't really care that much about our experiences. We care about me. And that is exactly what all of these logics and all of these Purvapaksha Siddhanta, huge, huge bhashyas and commentaries covering everything you could possibly imagine are just all pointing at this one simple me. It's so simple that Swamiji would laugh and say, it's so simple that our mind can't grasp it. At his house, it could not be more simple, and our minds are complex. And trying to do something big, like get enlightened, it's complex. Right? The mind is complex, and you are simple. So that's why, you know, they say that, they use these examples like, there's no greater secret than what the Upanishad has to reveal. It reveals the greatest secret in the world. Because the hardest secret to discover the truth of. Because the secret is, you know, what you're seeking is hidden, not in the seeker. It's not hidden. What you're trying to seek is not hidden in the seeker. It is the seeker. It is the very nature of the seeker. So wherever the seeker, you know, the mind, it's the self of the mind. So wherever the mind is looking, it's looking in the wrong direction. All right? Even if the mind is looking inward, it's still looking. It's looking in the inner space. This is outer space. You know? And so then the mind is looking for myself inwardly. But then that's directional. And so who is the one looking? And that's the me, the one who is illumining, right? The self of the one who is looking, the self of the mind. The mind that has sense organs, or the mind that has imagination, or the mind that has meditative mental states. The one who lights up those those sublime mental states, you know, those samadhi states of mind. I am just a simple me, you know, lighting up these states. If you think the samadhi, nirvikalpa samadhi and all of this, it's wonderful, there's nothing wrong with it. But it's a problem. It's a problem if you think you are that state, because that state comes and goes. Oh, I had this nirvikalpa samadhi. I was just there all by myself, and now I'm back. You know? You were there before, during, and after the nirvikalpa samadhi state, or the savikalpa samadhi state, or the extreme bliss state. You did not become that. And then, because if you became it, then you're also an object in time. You know? So it's fine to, if you know what those states are and what is happening, then they're very, very revealing, because you are focused upon that which doesn't change. But that's very tricky, because if you're focused upon, the mind is recognizing that which doesn't change, when you come back from that nirvikalpa state, you are still there, and you think, oh my God, I am still here. Just like when you wake up from the dream, I'm still here. When you get out of that nirvikalpa state, you realize that I am nirvikalpa. The mind had this experience, and then the experience comes and goes. But the self of that experience that was highlighted in that experience is still 100% present, and you also recognize, and it never has not been 100% present, and it has always been me. Even when I didn't label it properly, it has always been me, nobody else. Then these experiences, meditative experiences, we call it differently, we call it nididhyasana. Nididhyasana can result in different savikalpa, nirvikalpa, samadhi states, but they're not really that. From our standpoint, they are jnanam, jnanavrittis, because the teaching has taken you to that recognition, and then the mind absorbs in that, and you get it, and you see it, and when the mind comes back and does it as regular stuff, you're very clear about your own presence still being there. Then that's a beautiful thing, you know. But you don't need, you can have, in fact, we say in teaching, these nirvikalpa states come like that, just like that. Quickly, quickly, quickly seeing, like flashes. You see it, you see it, you see it. You know? That's all you need. You just need to see it. You know? And so, that's what Ramana is trying to do in this particular verse. So, that's good enough. Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavasishyate Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.
Can you also just sort of like I remember when I've been in suffering from a depressive state and I was trying to get rid of it, you know, like, oh, I don't want to be inside this. Can that also be a way of seeing the what you're talking about, or is that just...
No, you can, actually. That's really good exercise when you're feeling, you know, depressed or sad or all of these, is to just relax which is when we feel like that, we're often wanting to just push it away and get away from it. But sometimes it's better just to kind of relax and notice your own presence. You know, just accept it as it is. That takes a lot of tension away from the mind. If you can just accept it as it is and be present to it and notice your own presence. You can also, if you know how to do this, talking with your feelings, that also helps. You know, if you can accept the depressed state and talk to it and just say things like, tell me what's really bothering you. That, why that's important. It seems so simple, really. But when you say talk to it, you're actually, the buddhi is actually objectifying the manas at that time. And then the depressed state, which is kind of overwhelming the buddhi, now the buddhi, in a way, differentiates itself from the, if you just visualize like the manas, that depression being held in the manas, which is overwhelming the buddhi. And then the buddhi can talk to it and say, you know, tell me what is going on, or you're feeling so sad. And then it'll give it a chance to speak. But the big thing is the buddhi has then differentiated itself, so it's now holding it. So that's one thing you can do with those states, and it relaxes. It gives kind of a kindness to a kind presence to that isolated state. Any kind of depression is an isolated state where you feel isolated, and this all brings in company. But then from that standpoint, then you can also just kind of holding it, relax, and just notice the me, the conscious being you, that is there at the very center of that, you know, and just notice that, and that's also helps the depression to abate a little bit because the mind starts to relax.
So what you're noticing then is that permanent you?
Yeah, that the me is there exactly the same actually in every state. Whether it's a bliss state or a depressed state or an anxious state, what is satyam there never changes at all. And so, in fact, that's why some of these negative states juxtaposed against positive states is so useful. You know, because we tend to think of, I mean, I'm present only in the positive states. You know, and so I wait. Now here's the positive state. Here I am, you know. But, oh, Swamiji, and I remember all these kind of questions to Swamiji all the time. Swamiji, you know, I'm here when my mind is quiet and everything, but then when it's not, I'm gone. So it's just a total identification with the vritti, because such it ananda, we think there's supposed to be some bliss state, instead of what those words are actually pointing to. Ananda is something much more than a bliss state. So that's why there's all of these words create a lot of confusion.
When you use the word manas,
emotional state? We say that for the antakarana means the mind, okay? That the mind has four types of vrittis unto itself, not talking about perception, because with perception, that's different. Perception means you're using the sense organs to form antakarana vrittis in the mind based upon sense perception. But the mind itself can have four types of cognitions. At least they break it into these four types. One is the buddhi. It means that's like the intellect. And it's decisive thinking. It's like a knowledge or clarity, the buddhi. Then the ahankara is the I notion. That's a type of thought. The manas is the fluctuating mind, indecisive. And often we put, you know, emotional states, if we want to put them somewhere, we can put them in the manas. And that can be like where is the knowledge or the experience of the emotion? What level of mind is holding that? And we'll say the manas. And the manas can sometimes then overwhelm the buddhi. So we'll put it in the manas. The fourth one is citta, the memory. And the citta memory, we can put the unconscious if we want to, and that we have to explain all of that because Vedanta doesn't do that. But the and the sanchitta karma, you know, all the storehouse of karmas has to go in the memory. It's more like in the unconscious level of the memory. So these they just have these four kinds of states that the mind is capable of. Does that make sense?
That's great, yeah.
Yes.
Can you say maybe something, it's not a form of thought, but this identification from the body.
Yeah.
And the difference, like the direction, it's a very slippery road to spiritual bypassing and not wanting to be in pain or suffering by that notion that we are like more than what is. I mean, I don't know. If
you I would say like this, that in fact, see the physical. This physical body is a live body as opposed to a dead body. Okay. So what we would say, what makes this body a live body is that there's a subtle body abiding in it. And that subtle body goes throughout, pervades the entire body. Right? And so when the soul departs or the jiva departs, that sukshma sharira that has, I'm just going to tell you all of this and just to make a deeper sense of it, okay? So the subtle body, when the subtle body, because of your karmas, takes on a physical body, then the subtle body, which is comprises 19 components, it's got the five pranas that enliven the body, it's got the organs of action that allow the body to move and to do things for the body, as the five sense organs, eyes, ears, nose, etc., sense of touch. And then it also has the mind, that has these four components, the ahankara, you know, the I notion, the memory, the buddhi, and the manas, these four. That's 19 components that make up what we call the subtle body. And the subtle body is basically made out of, comprised of, in terms of maya, if you like to use this kind of model, it can be helpful, the sattva and rajas. Because that which enlivens the body with all of the active principle and the sattva, that which allows for nourishment. So that's the sukshma sharira means subtle body, takes on this tamas, it's gone through this panchakarana, this is the physical body. So that the subtle body takes body after body after body. So now, the subtle body also, because of the antakarana, it and the five sense organs, it pervades and enlivens this body with consciousness, right? Because this has the sense of touch runs throughout the whole body. And so this whole body is pervaded by consciousness because of the sense of touch. And then the sense organs that are located in the body are enlivened by the subtle body also, by the sense organs. In the brain, the mind, all of the sensory perception. So this whole thing becomes an instrument. The body with the sense organs, the whole thing is an instrument that the sukshma sharira uses in order to interact with this world. So now, this subtle body with the sense of touch gives me, you know, total pervasion to this physical body. And so, with consciousness. And so I, in fact, because of the subtle body, totally enliven this body. And I also totally enliven all, because of the manas, because of the sattva, all of the emotions, all of the thoughts, all of the feelings, everything is totally enlivened by me, right? And so I am, from the standpoint of this body, I am the self of it, you know. I mean, there's no distance between me and this. And so now what has to be recognized is that the me, which this whole body is enjoying right now, is also completely free of this whole body. I have to recognize that. Once I recognize that, then this idea of spiritual bypass actually should not be there, because I have no need to have spiritual bypass. I can be totally present with my feelings and heal them, right? I can heal them because this is the difference. if I don't recognize my presence in these emotions, then I am the emotion. Right? If I am the emotion, then how am I going to help it? Somebody has to come and help me. Right? Because I'm just the emotion. Then I have to either distract myself, try to find another emotion, or try to get somebody to be there present to it, to hold me in some way. But I can't hold myself. But if I can hold myself, which is the reality of it anyway, it just requires some viveka, then I'm not afraid of the emotion, and I can be totally present to it in a way that makes a huge, huge difference. And so it's not at all about trying to escape pain. It's that I can actually be with pain in a complete and whole way, without fear, in a way that actually is soothing and healing. You know, it's just, I look at it too, like in the world, if you have a little child, you will put, the child is crying and hurt and all, the mother will put the child on her lap and hold it and, you know, be present to it. And then that child goes through its pain and whatnot in the presence of somebody who holds it. You know, and then it can be okay. If it's not held, it has to go into its room, you know, with nobody there, all alone, then the pain just gets worse and worse, and you want to run away from it, and you want to maybe go to sleep or do something to get away, to get out of it, because there's no one there. Or here, someone is there. So you're free to be with the pain in a way that is helpful, and both you and the pain know it, that it's helpful. So you're not afraid. See what I mean?
Yeah.
So actually it's the opposite. But that has to all be part of the teaching also.
Well,
because otherwise you would say, like sometimes they would make fun of people as being walking heads. In other words, that just shove all of the emotions and everything down and just stay in the ether, walking around as a walking head.
Well,
but I don't think that's Vedanta.
Well, how do you be with the pain when you say to yourself, I illumine this, I'm aware of this, I mean this is not touched, but there the pain is? What do you mean by it?
I would say like this. That's why there's a recognition of your own presence. It's not even about, in this case, it's not even about saying, I am free from the pain. That's a fact, that yourself is free from the pain. But it's that fact allows you to be with the pain. So for instance, say you're hurting. You're very, you know, you're distraught and you're hurting, you know. Your buddhi, it's a two types of buddhi. One can say, well, I'm not that pain. I'm free of the pain. Okay. I don't think that's very compassionate. When the buddhi knows I am free of the pain, I am free, because it recognizes the part that is free, then it can be that one that recognizes the self can be with that pain, like you would be with a child, and say, you know, tell me what is wrong. Tell what's really going on. It's very funny. If you talk to your feelings and ask them what it is, what's really bothering you, or why are you upset? And then if you can start saying, well, so-and-so did such and such. Yeah, but why is that hurting you so much? What is really wrong? You know, where does this come from? If you say that with kindness, it'll talk with you. You know, it's like the buddhi splitting into manas and buddhi. And it will respond. And it likes you to talk. The unconscious really likes you to talk to it, and it will talk back to you. You know, but this is, people are becoming more educated around this, but I think that at least what Jung will say is, you know, like from the 17th century on, the really scientific revolution and all of that, we started just looking outward and looking at the unconscious or the imaginal faculties, all is just fantasy, and not having any type of relationship with our feelings or different parts of the unconscious, no type of exchange. And so we became very, like, flat, without you know, without any type of interrelationship, just external relationships. And the inner psyche was not really cared for or taken seriously at all. But once, it's very easy to turn that around. You just have to be taught and play with it a little bit. Yeah. You know?
See, the cat doesn't know how to do that.
Well, you could,
it's true.
Oh, yes, God. Yeah.
I appreciate the idea of talking to the hurt, but also can you just kind of let it flow and just...
Yeah, you can. You can in the end. You know, that becomes very natural because your own presence is a healing presence. And it without words is holding you. You don't need the words. At some point you don't need those words because the fact of those words is taking care of you. You know, you are that without saying that. But that doesn't mean you can say it also. But you don't need to say it because it's already taking place.
Can you talk about faith in self?
What?
Faith in self. I heard in Sanskrit the word for faith is siddha or something like that.
Shraddha.
Oh, okay. And the fundamental quality of it, or the most basic, is a faith in self.
No, okay. This word shraddha, it means faith in the shastra, means faith in the Upanishads or the teaching, and in the teacher. Now, it's a faith pending understanding. And so this is the idea of it. It's like if you undertake any study, right, you have to have some feeling that this study that I'm undertaking is useful and meaningful to me. And you would also have to think, say you're taking a class from somebody, and you really want to learn this, and you're taking a class, you would like to think that the one who's teaching the class actually knows the subject matter. And you would like to think that the textbook that's being used is a valid source of knowledge for what you're seeking, right? And so that's also true in this teaching. First of all, there has to be something in you that has shraddha, because you don't really know what the result of this teaching will be until you have studied it, right? So you have to have some shraddha, faith pending understanding, to allow you to study it in the first place. So that's a certain faith, because you don't know. So you have that shraddha. And you have to have some faith that the teacher knows what he or she is talking about. And you also don't know that, because the teacher could be just a buffoon or just a blabbermouth or not knowing. You know, so shraddha is that something, it's actually called, you know, the grace of God, that you even have any shraddha. Because you don't know the end result of it until you expose yourself to it. So that's what shraddha is. It's considered one of the qualifications for a qualified student. We have, you have viveka, the discrimination, and vairagya, a certain type of dispassion. And then there's a set of six, and mumukshutvam is the fourth one, desire for liberation. But then there's these six mental qualities, and the last one is shraddha. There's shama, dhamma, you know, the being able to control your thoughts and control your acting out, you know, and being able to be single-pointed in your pursuit and be able to maintain equipoise, titiksha, in the opposites that the universe throws at you, not lose your equipoise, and be able to focus your mind, samadhan, and shraddha. You know, because say you have no shraddha, in, say, the Upanishads, you can't even listen to them because your mind is already negating them without giving them a chance, right? Or if you, and say the the Upanishads actually have to be wielded. They have to be taught by a teacher. They're a teaching methodology, actually. And so say the Shraddha, you don't have any Shraddha in the veracity or the teacher really knows what he or she is talking about, then how can you really listen? So that's why Shraddha is so important. It's not Shraddha in yourself, though we could talk about it like that, but when we are using it as a technical term, that's what it means.
Yeah. Well, what if we talk about a faith in the self?
Faith in the self would be, depends on what level. I mean, having faith in yourself to me would mean on the level of myself as a jiva, that I give myself the benefit of the doubt and I have respect. You know, that I'm a friend of myself and I have respect, and I also know that I'm a good person and I'm doing my best. That's very positive. You know, a lot of people have a very critical voice. So to be able to have that respect, you know, friendship toward myself would be that. On a bigger level, faith in myself is faith in Ishwara. You know, I recognize that this whole Ishwara is an expression of the self, of my being. So in a lot of different levels. Just usually we probably wouldn't use Shraddha for that, because Shraddha has a specific meaning.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, it's a technical term.
Yeah.
So it's not the way in which I sort of come to accept or understand myself as self?
That's not Shraddha.
Oh, okay.
Shraddha really has to do with your relationship, your openness to the teaching and to the teacher who's teaching it. Because that, and that's not, and it's faith pending understanding. It's got an end. It's not like Shraddha, it's not like faith in an unknown that will never, well, but it just allows the mind the ability to study, the ability to listen. Because without the ability to listen, you can't gain this knowledge to then debate with it, to ask questions, what about this and what about that? Because your mind's not even able to be present to it to understand. Then, say if your mind is able to be present, then we look at what are the sadhanas for actually gaining that from the standpoint of the teaching itself. And the first one is shravana, which means receiving that teaching, being able to hear it, and to gain clarity on exactly what the Upanishads are saying. So there can be a lot of logic, a lot of question and answer, you know, on are the Upanishads saying this? Are they saying that? What do they mean exactly? What are they saying? So that's shravana, gaining that knowledge of what they say. Manana is then debating whether or not it has to be that way. This is what the Upanishads say. That's shravana. So you get clarity that way. Manana is, yeah, but it could be like this also. Like, why does it have to be like that? How do I know that what the Upanishads, I know what they're saying, but how do I know that's true? So then manana is that where the mind, whatever doubts are there about the veracity of that teaching, then that discussion has to take place until the mind understands and is convinced. Until the mind is convinced, it has to keep asking and questioning. That's manana. Nididhyasana is where I actually contemplate, you know, where I'm owning up that teaching in order to break through that very strong, what we call dehatma buddhi, that conviction that the body is the self. So the mind has to spend some time differentiating, and that's what we call meditation. So nididhyasana is the word that we use. So shravana, manana, nididhyasana. And then all of that has to take place in your mind, as your mind needs certain qualifications of being able to even be available, you know, for listening. Because here's all of these words coming, but your mind can be off here and there, and, you know, or the mind has to be able to be available. And one of the things that needs to be available is Shraddha. It also has to have some mumukshutvam, desire for liberation. If there's no desire for liberation, why would you sit and listen to all this, right? So this, the, what we call the adhikari, the qualified student, has this, what's called sadhana chatushtya. This group, chatushtya means a group of four sadhanas, viveka, vairagya, you know, shama, dhammadi, and then the mumukshutvam, these four. And Shraddha is one, you know. And that Shraddha, in the Bhagavad Gita, there's this one verse that says, Shraddha van babate jnanam. The one who has Shraddha gains knowledge. Without that Shraddha, then no matter what you have, all of the, you have all of these qualifications, but the one that allows you really to know, to be present, isn't there. So it's considered the most important of the qualifications. Everything else can come. The teacher can even make a mumukshu out of you. One who desires liberation, because we spend a lot of time, in fact, honing in on exactly what the problem is. The student can come with more or less feeling of bondage, you know, but it's not really clear, but the teacher will make it clear. So the teacher can even make a mumukshu out of you, you know, if that Shraddha is there. You know, and all the viveka. Also, you have some viveka, but the teacher will expand and expand on viveka, vairagya, all of these things. So. Oh, there's a question here. Let me get this up. Okay, Michael. I'm ready for your question. So maybe I can. Okay, are you going to type it in? It's quite off topic. That's all right. Oh, the fig trees. I don't know very much about that. Well, you can type it out. Well, I can think about it anyway. Oh, God. My question is quite unrelated to tonight's topic. I am just curious about Sanatana Dharma's explanation of the difference between reincarnation and the Pitris. The Garbha Upanishad tells how the soul travels between births, like this Atma and Karmashaya, etc., travel out of the Deha after death. It goes into the clouds and eventually, oh, I don't know anything about this stuff. It goes into the clouds and eventually, when the planets reflect the karmani surrounding the jiva, the atma comes to the earth and rain. Okay, this is all, I know I'm not going to have anything to say about this, but I know that this is in some of the Upanishads. They say it in different ways, Michael. It's even in ways that are contradictory, but it's more poetic. They got stuck in their Pitraloka because of karma.
Sorry.
That's his language. No, I can't answer it. We have to ask Swamiji this kind of question. He can answer that. He'll have a lot to say, because he knows all of that. I don't know. Sorry. When they talk about the sperm and the ovum getting together at different times, I think there's three or four in the Upanishads, different versions of that. But yeah, that's wrong. Okay. Oops.
what Upanishad was he?
He wasn't quoting in the Upanishad. I'm trying to think. I think it's in the. I think it's one of the Upanishads is the Prashna. I think the one that he's quoting there is from the Prashna. But there's at least three different versions of when and how the soul comes into the body, at what time, what goes on. And they're more poetic and they're contradictory a little bit also.
How many Upanishads are there?
Huh?
How many Upanishads are there?
I don't know. I mean, like, there's 11 that Shankara commented on, but I think, like, I know that there's 180 Upanishads.
Yeah. 180, you said?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Most of them we never even heard of.
Yeah. But we usually focus on the Upanishads that Shankara has written in Bhasha. Those are the ones that we teach, and those are the ones that they're like the most important ones. I have a book of 108 of them. Mm.
This one is small.
Oh, yeah.
This one called the King of the Upanishads. It starts with an M. Darn.
With an M? The Mahanarayana?
No, there's there's two that sound very similar, and you've got one of them on your side that you did.
Mundaka and Mandukya.
The Mundaka and Mandukya.
Yeah, it's the Mandukya.
Yeah.
They refer to as the King of the Upanishad, is that right?
I haven't heard that, but it's usually the last Upanishad that's taught.
Is that right? Because
mm-hmm.
I noticed it wasn't
so really focuses on non-duality. I've done like the first chapter of it several years ago.
Oh.
We haven't got to the second chapter yet.
Oh.
Yeah, we should do that sometime.
There's the 10 that Shankara, and then there's like...
Padvalya.
There's the Chandogya.
Vrhadaranyaka. And
Are
then
those,
we also do...
On, did he comment on those? Or?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He did.
And
then there's
are,
another one that we teach that he didn't comment on, the Kaivalya.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we'll teach that one, too, for the next 12.
You say you have or you will?
Yeah. No, I teach that one. Yeah. Kaivalya. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the other
two... Shankara doesn't have a bhasha on it.
The Chandogya and the...
Vrhadaranyaka.
Yeah, those are...
Huge. That's why we don't teach the whole thing. We'd be there here for 12 years. The Vrhadaranyaka is huge. But Swamiji, and so is the Chandogya, is big too. But a lot of it is more upasana and things that aren't maybe immediately useful for us. But there are very important sections in those two Upanishads, and Swamiji will teach those sections.
There's another one that's really long. Is it a Viveka?
Viveka Chidamani.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a book of like the 108 verses out of that.
Yes.
They pull the most important things.
I've taught that. Because that's a Prakarana Granta, means an explanatory text. And it's kind of a compilation of repeating themes. And so Swamiji just went through and pulled out the thread. You know, it's like somebody came along and put a lot of sections together. Some of the sections are very similar. So it doesn't hold together as a logical sequence. And so he took the 108 verses, and that just cuts through that.
Wow.
It's very nice.
Yeah. Yeah,
and it's a nice commentary on it, too.
It's interesting that the number 108... Like 108 Upanishads, 108 verses.
Yeah,
it's
absurd.
It's like the mala.
Yeah,
108.
That's right.
Beings.
Yeah,
because he had to find 108 exactly. Because it's this special number, right?
Yeah. I don't remember the story. I'm sure I've heard it many times. I don't remember. Okay, let's stop. I'm going to meet with somebody tonight. And Kristen, I want to make some time with you.